afternoon, and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live from 2 to 3 in the afternoon Pacific time. If you'd like to be a part of this program, that's what it is here for, to hear from you. If you want to call, I can talk to you in this coming hour, and you can talk to me and to our audience. And that would be especially if you have some kind of a question perplexing you about the Bible or about Christianity, anything in the Bible, anything you've read that just doesn't make sense to you. Or maybe you don't believe the Bible and you think the Bible's full of contradictions or problems. If you'd like to bring that up here, feel free to do that. If you disagree with the host about anything that's ever been said here by yours truly, feel free to call and to balance comment about that as well. This is open discussion about the Bible. It's called the Narrow Path for the simple reason that Jesus used that image when he said it's a difficult path that leads to the narrow gate, which leads to eternal life. And he said there's a broad path that's an easy path, and that leads to a broad gate, but that leads to destruction. He said there's lots of people on the broad path, but there's not very many people on the narrow path. Now, I have always been one inclined to take Jesus seriously. So if he said that the path that leads to eternal life is one that not many people are on, and it's narrow and difficult, then it seems to me that it may take a little more effort, I suppose, to discover that path and to remain on it. If it's difficult, as Jesus said, then it presumably is going to take some attention on our part to make sure that we're on that path that leads to eternal life. So I consider that the words of Jesus himself and the words of the apostles and the other things in the Bible provide for us a description, a definition, a map of that path. And so I decided many years ago, more than 40 years ago now, that I was going to stay on that path if I could. And I was going to study what God had said in order to understand what I can, which will help me to stay in God's will, if possible, to help me to do the thing that pleases God, if possible. Now, why do I want to do that? Well, partly because Jesus said that's the path that leads to eternal life, but also for a different reason. Even if there was no eternal life, it seems to me that if God made me, he owns me, and there's every reason that my life should be defined by fulfilling the purpose he had for me. After all, if he made me, he has every right to expect to get from me whatever he made me for. And I'll never know what that is unless I consult what he said in his word. So that's what I do. I consult his word. But of course, there's many things in the Bible that I don't fully understand. And for that reason, I'm definitely open to discussion. And so the purpose of this program is not simply to showcase the personal views of the host, but rather to invite open discussion. And if you disagree with something the host has said, your opinion is as welcome here as mine. So just keep that in mind. And if you have something you'd like to discuss here with us on the air, we have lines open right now. And you can call me at 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Today and all week, I'm broadcasting from the Seattle, Washington area. I usually broadcast from my home in Santa Cruz, California. But this week, I'm teaching for Youth with a Mission, a group of Korean students. This is largely a Korean YWAM base where the classes are taught in the Korean language. Now, I don't speak Korean, so we use a translator. But I've taught here regularly. I've come here every year for some time. And they have just opened a beautiful new facility. They've been building it for 9 years. And this is the first time I've been here that they've got the new facilities open. Lovely place. And what's more, if you're perhaps not aware, this summer I am going to be teaching a biblical school for 10 weeks. And they're letting us use the facilities right here in Monroe, Washington. The YWAM facilities, the new facilities. They're beautiful. They're comfortable. They're nice. They're beautifully situated. And they are being made available to us very inexpensively. Now, the amount they quoted to me to charge for room and board for our students to stay here while we have the school in the summertime is so low, I was astounded. They're going to be serving three cooked meals a day and providing room and board for $20 a day per person. I found out yesterday in talking to some of the leaders that that's a greatly reduced price, more than, like, reduced by 50% of what they would charge in most cases. But that's because although the school I'm going to be teaching this summer is not a YWAM-affiliated school, it's going to be an entirely independent school, yet YWAM, at least some people in YWAM, apparently are excited enough about this school that they really wanted to help it happen. And so giving us such a low room and board price, they say, is their investment in our school, which I thought was very magnanimous of them. If you don't know about the school I'm going to be teaching here in the Seattle area in the summertime, you might want to read about it. You can do so very easily. You go to our website. Our website is thenarrowpath.com. And there's a link there that says the new Great Commission School. Check that out and read about it. Actually, students who come from anywhere other than the Seattle area will be living here on the base, as I mentioned, for those 10 weeks. It's a live-in immersion program where we'll be studying the Bible, actually day and night. And if you live in the area, if you happen to live in the Monroe or Seattle area, and you don't need to live here, that is, you don't have to live on the campus, you're welcome to come to the classes, and there's no charge. So, you want to read about that? You can get a description of the course by going to thenarrowpath.com and clicking on the link that says the new Great Commission School. Well, we've got our lines filling up. We have one line open still. If you'd like to be on the program, the number is 1-800-438-5090. All right, we're going to talk first to Tom. He was our first caller today from Silverton, Oregon. Tom, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The last two evenings, PBS has run a series on Mormonism, and it looks like a series that they had run maybe a year or two ago. I didn't see it then, but there was a scholar on there, and he was talking about, not a Mormon scholar, but a historian or an archaeologist, I can't remember what, but he was talking about the Mormon claim of the peoples or the Jews that had come to America. I think you're familiar with that.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. You know, and he was very adamant about, you know, there's just absolutely no evidence at all, you know, in DNA and, you know, just no archaeological evidence that was even possible. And my question, though, is, and then he said it was similar to the claim of the Bible or that of the Exodus, that there's absolute, you know, he was referring to the Exodus. He put that on the same par with the Bible's claim of the Exodus. There's no proof out there that such a thing ever happened.
I know both issues. It's not strange that PBS that they would, equate the Bible with the Book of Mormon. There's no comparison at all. Of course, it is true that the Book of Mormon makes a lot of historical claims about events that happened in pre-colonial America, which cannot be verified from archaeology, and which should be able to be if they were true. For example, the Book of Mormon claims that North America was covered with buildings, that they had built big cities, and the whole land was covered with buildings. Well, there's no evidence of such buildings in pre-colonial America. The Indians, the Native Americans, generally didn't build buildings. They were nomadic, and they lived in, you know, movable structures most of the time. And archaeologists have not been able to find any evidence of all these buildings that were supposedly covering the ground. The Book of Mormon claims that the inhabitants of North America had horses and pigs and cows and even, it says, elephants. Now, there's no evidence that there were ever horses or pigs or cows on this continent before the colonists from Europe brought them, and certainly no elephants. So, in other words, there's a lot of things the Book of Mormon claims that should be archaeologically verifiable, but they simply aren't. Now, the Bible makes lots of historical claims about things that it says transpired in the Middle East, and archaeology has been able to uncover a great number of confirmations of almost all the different periods that the Bible talks about. However, the Exodus is one of those things that for a long time skeptics have said, you know, we really don't have any proof that the Israelites you know, did travel out of Egypt at the time that is recorded, and through the Sinai Peninsula and so forth. And therefore, some have said that it's not archaeologically verifiable. One of the problems that they had, which has been remedied somewhat recently, is that they were looking in the wrong place. You see, there is a place in the Sinai Peninsula called Mount Sinai. At least it's identified with Mount Sinai traditionally. This identification was made by Constantine's mother. Many of the alleged holy sites in the biblical lands that have been identified as tourist attractions and so forth, many of them were identified by Constantine's mother. When Constantine the emperor became Christian, his mother came down into the Middle East and began to look for the sites of many famous biblical stories. And by revelation, she claimed to know them. And she identified a lot of the places that you'll see on a Holy Land tour, including she identified a particular mountain in the Sinai Peninsula as Mount Sinai. And forever since, that's been the traditional site of Mount Sinai, and it's in the Sinai Peninsula. Now, the truth is, they have not been able to find archaeological evidence in the Sinai Peninsula of millions of Jews traveling through there. You'd think that some of their artifacts would have been left behind. And yet there hasn't really been evidence found. And for a long time, people have said, well, therefore, there's no evidence that the Exodus took place or that the Exodus is a true story. However, in the last several years, maybe the last couple of decades, it has come to light that the traditional site of Mount Sinai is the wrong place, and that the real Mount Sinai was almost certainly not in the Sinai Peninsula. The reason for that is because Moses first discovered Mount Sinai when he was tending sheep for his father-in-law Jethro. And we are told that his father-in-law was a priest in Midian, and that Moses had fled from Egypt and gone to Midian. Well, Midian isn't the Sinai Peninsula. Actually, in Moses' day, the Sinai Peninsula was still part of Egypt's territory. But if you cross the Gulf of Aqaba, you come to what was the land of Midian. I believe that's Saudi Arabia now. And that's where you should look for Mount Sinai, because Moses was tending the sheep of his father-in-law in Midian when he came upon the burning bush, which was on Mount Sinai. And Moses later brought the children of Israel out of Egypt and back to that same mountain where they received the law. So the real Mount Sinai isn't in the Sinai Peninsula. It's in Midian, which is Saudi Arabia. And there's been much archaeological discoveries there that confirm that the Israelites were there. There's even a probable site for them to have crossed the Gulf of Aqaba into Midian, and there's been underwater explorations there where there appears to be even a shallow land bridge across that gulf into the place approximately where Israel would have gone, and that if the water had parted, this particular land bridge would have been the natural way for them to walk. And submarine photographs exist. You can see some of them on YouTube, but you can get full length video documentaries on this. They photographed what appeared to be chariot wheels and things like that on the bottom of the gulf there. And on the other side, there is a mountain that is traditionally, not traditionally in Christian lands, but the Arabs recognize it as the real Mount Sinai. It's interesting because it's burned on top, just as if there was fire and so forth on top, like the Bible describes. There's even encampments at the bottom of this mountain that have lots of evidence that there were large numbers of people encamped there for a period of time. There's even rocks with Hebrew inscriptions on them and so forth. There's lots of archaeological things that have been discovered there. But the problem is this Mount Sinai in Arabia, which, by the way, Paul said in Galatians chapter 4, that Mount Sinai was in Arabia, which is, of course, Midian. Not the Gulf of Sinai. I mean, not the Sinai Peninsula, excuse me. But this whole area is fenced off by the Saudi Arabian government, and they do not let people in there. The photographs and videos that have been taken have largely been done secretly and illegally. And to do outright excavations there and so forth is not at this time permitted by the Saudi Arabian government. But notwithstanding those laws against it, there have come back many photographs and so forth of the things that are actually there, which a person, if he can get over there, can see. And there's been a number of people who have brought back similar photographs from that area. So I believe that once it becomes common knowledge that the real Mount Sinai is actually in Saudi Arabia and not in the Sinai Peninsula, and once they are able to do some research and look in the right place, I think you'll find there's plenty of archaeological support for the Israelites coming out of Egypt and going there.
Okay, well, thanks. This guy, whoever he was, some expert, he should have, I mean, if you're an expert in your field, you should know the latest, you know, information.
A lot of people are called experts who actually have a particular axe to grind. There's a lot of Bible scholars, for example, who don't believe the Bible's true. You might be surprised to hear that, but lots of universities have biblical studies departments that are run by people who don't have a bit of respect for the Bible. And so there are people who are called experts, but they're very much biased in a certain way toward unbelief. I admit, I am biased toward belief. But my bias is somewhat due to the fact that I've looked at a lot of evidences that incline me to think the Bible has been proven to be correct again and again by archaeology. And therefore, when I hear that there's, for example, no archaeological evidence that Bethlehem was an inhabited city in the days of Jesus, as sometimes they say, I think, well, just let them keep digging, because again and again, critics have said there, you know, there's no archaeological evidence for this biblical story or for this biblical character. And then they are embarrassed because, I mean, they end up finding irrefutable evidence for them, for Belshazzar, for Sargon II, for the existence of Sodom and Gomorrah, for lots of places that the critics once said, well, we don't have any evidence of this from archaeology. Well, be patient. They eventually find it, and they have for many, many things. And I believe that in time it'll be common knowledge that Mount Sinai is in Arabia and that there's lots of archaeological evidence of the Hebrews having encamped there.
Yeah, and I really believe that science and archaeology has, I mean, it gives me even more confidence in the veracity of the Bible and the historical record of the Bible, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And that was what I took away from this, you know, listening to this series. That was really sad to me. Overall, my impression was that, and, you know, I don't want to offend any Mormons, but you have to be intellectually dishonest to really believe the claims of Mormonism, whereas to believe the claims of the Bible, the evidence is everywhere. And
well, yeah, the two documents do not stand on the same footing in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, right. So, anyway, hey, thanks a lot, Steve. I appreciate it.
All right, Tom. Thanks for your call.
Okay. Bye.
Bye now. And that opens up a line for you if you'd like to join us on the program. You're listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. The number to call is 1-800-438-5090. It's 1-800-438-5090. Our next caller is Carolyn from Carmel. Thanks for waiting so long, Carolyn. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks, Steve. Let's see. I'm a second-time caller. Anyway, I'm at work, and I just wanted to pose a question that was presented to me yesterday at work, and your show was actually on, and I said, call him. He'll give you a much better answer, and he didn't want to call, so maybe he's listening today. His name is Ed, and he had a question that I could give very limited sense of, but it was just about, and I felt he had some underlying disgruntlement about the Bible in general, but his basic question was, why do Christians spend so much time concentrating on the Old Testament when everything's been fulfilled and, you know, we're following Jesus and that sort of thing? So I don't know if that's something too broad for you to tackle, but or just something you can handle simply, but if you wouldn't mind, I'll take the answer off the air, and maybe he's listening today too.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Carolyn, for asking.
Uh-huh. You're welcome.
God bless you.
Thanks.
Bye now. Well, the question is, why do Christians spend so much time studying the Old Testament when the New Testament is the document of the Christian faith? Well, there's several parts to my answer to that. One is, I had not noticed that Christians spend a lot of time studying the Old Testament. In my opinion, Christians are not as literate as they should be in the Old Testament. In fact, Christians are generally not very literate in the Bible at all, but when they are, they're usually more familiar with the New Testament if they are Bible readers. Now, if they're just kids who went to Sunday school and don't read the Bible, but they just know about the Bible, what they heard in Sunday school, they might know mostly Old Testament stories about Samson and about David and Goliath and about the walls of Jericho and things like that. Old Testament stories are often remembered, at least vaguely, by people who've been to Sunday school but maybe aren't Bible readers. But when you find Christians who really do read their Bibles, it seems to me more often than not they concentrate on reading the New Testament. And there's obviously a good reason to do so, because the New Testament tells us the most specific things about our faith that have been revealed through Christ and his apostles. But why would Christians, any Christians, myself, for example, I have studied the Old Testament quite a lot. Why would I concentrate on the Old Testament? Well, I don't. I don't really concentrate on the Old Testament. I concentrate on the New Testament because I believe that's, as I say, the superior revelation. But I don't ignore the Old Testament. We need to remember that the Old Testament was the only Bible that Jesus ever preached from. It was the only Bible that the apostles ever preached from. That's the only Bible they had. And they said very many very positive things about it. Every time you find Jesus saying something positive about the Scriptures, or when you hear Paul or Peter telling us about the Scriptures and how they're inspired by God, they are referring to what we call the Old Testament. That's the only Scriptures they had. And so they believed that the Old Testament was God's word to Israel. Now, if they realized that a new covenant had come and replaced the old covenant, that doesn't mean that history had to be rewritten to replace real history. The Old Testament gives primarily historical information. It's primarily the story of how God created and set out to rescue fallen men, and the stories of God's redemption have many things about them that are valuable to us. They show a precedent of God's character in his dealings with Israel. They show many things that foreshadow things that he was going to do in the new covenant. Many of the practices of the Jews and even many of the stories of the Old Testament serve as what the Bible calls types of Christ. The Passover ceremony, for example, is a pretty well-known case. David's life is a type of the life of Christ and so forth. And the word type means a foreshadowing, something that is a mold or a shape that resembles the shape of something else. And the shape of David's life, the shape of the practices of Israel in the tabernacle, they correspond to a spiritual shape of things. And the New Testament tells us many times what those things are. But sometimes the New Testament doesn't identify it. But we can discover that just by reading the Old Testament. The Old Testament is a valuable book. And if people say, well, Christians don't need the Old Testament because they're not under the law, well, it should be understood that the law is not the whole Old Testament. The law is really the laws that God gave only occupy a pretty small portion of the Old Testament. The Old Testament is made of 39 books. Only about three of them, or perhaps four at the most, really contain the laws of God. And therefore, that means there's 35 books that don't contain the law. What do they contain? Well, some of them contain history. And history is always valuable. It certainly is valuable for us to know what God has done in the past, because he doesn't change. And we can know somewhat the kinds of things we might expect him to do in the future as well, or now. A lot of those books are prophecy. And when you read prophecies, you're hearing God express what his intentions are. And some of those prophecies have been fulfilled. In fact, hundreds of biblical prophecies have been fulfilled. When we read about those, it inspires us to see that our God knows the future. He tells the future and he carries it out. And that's an inspiration to us to know that we're really worshiping the God who orders history and knows the future and can guide our lives because he knows what we don't know, namely what the future holds. That's very important to us. And when we read about the prophecies that have been fulfilled, that inspires that. There are some prophecies perhaps that have not been fulfilled, in which case they tell us what to look forward to. There are the Psalms. Now, the Psalms are the largest book in the Old Testament, and they contain essentially worship and prayers. There's not really law in there. It's not really history either, although there's some retelling of Israel's history in some of the Psalms. But they are expressions of worship from a man after God's own heart. Now, Christians love to worship. Christians are called to worship. And yet, in knowing how to worship properly, we sometimes gain aid by examples of a man who is a great worshiper and seeing how he worshiped God. As a matter of fact, the early Christians quoted from the book of Psalms more often than they quoted from any other book of the Old Testament. They used Psalms for their singing. In fact, in the New Testament, Paul and James, both in their books, tell us that we should sing the Psalms. They mean the book of Psalms. James said, "Is any of you merry? That is cheerful. Let him sing the Psalms." Paul said in Ephesians 4 and in Colossians, I think it's chapter 3, he said that we should speak to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. So the Psalms become the worship curriculum, as it were, for the Christian, because they are wonderful and inspired expressions of acceptable worship to God. There are books like Proverbs and Ecclesiastes. What are those? Those are books of wisdom. Those are books of good advice, practical wisdom of how to live and so forth. Those are valuable. In other words, when you look at the Old Testament, it's kind of a mistake to say, well, we're not under the law, so we don't need the Old Testament. Well, true, we're not under the law, but most of the Old Testament is not the law. Most of the Old Testament is a lot of other stuff, all of which is just as valuable to people living today as it was valuable to the first people who received it from God. The purpose of history hasn't changed its value. Prophecy, its value hasn't changed. Wisdom, its value hasn't changed. Worship of God, that hasn't changed. And that's what you find in the majority of the Old Testament books. Now, what about those few books that do have the laws? Well, it's not as if they have no value to us. David himself said that he meditated on the law day and night, and it made him like a tree planted by rivers of water, bringing forth fruit in his season, and whatever he did would prosper. And so meditation on the law is really a way of getting a sense of the character of God. Because even though we are not under the ceremonial and ritual laws, which occupy so much of those law books in the Old Testament, a lot of those law books, like Leviticus, it's almost entirely devoted to how to worship at the tabernacle, how to offer animal sacrifices, how to avoid getting defiled by unclean animals and things like that. Well, none of those things are directly relevant to us because we don't worship at the tabernacle anymore. We don't have the animal sacrifices anymore. But even those are not without value to us because the ceremonies were foreshadowing spiritual truths. And we see this, for example, illustrated by Paul. There's one of the ceremonial laws in the Bible says, "You shall not plow with an ox and a donkey together." Now, that sounds like a weird thing to say. What is the purpose of that? Well, an ox to the Jew was a clean animal. A donkey was an unclean animal. And Paul, seeing that law had a spiritual significance, he said to the Christians, "Do not be unequally yoked together with unbelievers." You see, like the ox, the Christian is a clean animal, so to speak. And like the donkey, the unbeliever is like an unclean animal. And you don't yoke them together. A yoke is what you put over animals' necks so that they will plow or do whatever you want them to do. And Paul said, you Christians should not be unequally yoked with unbelievers. It's the same lesson as you don't plow with an ox and a donkey together under one yoke. And so Paul saw a spiritual application of that. There's another law in Deuteronomy that says you should not muzzle the ox while it's treading out the grain. It's referring to the fact that when they ground their grain, they had these huge millstones, which were too heavy for people to move. And so they had oxen harnessed to these millstones to move them to crush the grain. But the law said, while an ox is doing that, you should not put a muzzle on it. And what that meant is you should not restrict it from eating. It should be able to take a mouthful now and then when it's working. And Paul quoted that law, but he didn't quote it as a law that we are to keep with reference to oxen. He actually quotes it. He says, it is written, you shall not muzzle the ox that treads out the grain. This is in 1 Corinthians 9. And then he says, now does God care for oxen, or did he say it altogether for our sakes? Paul asks rhetorically. And then he points out that what God's really getting across is that those who are serving, like an ox serves its master, those who are serving God in the ministry should not be restricted from eating. That is to say, they should not be withheld their provisions. So Paul saw this Old Testament law, you should not muzzle the ox that treads out the grain. He saw that as presenting a principle that people who are serving God in the ministry should be fed and should not be made to serve without eating. What I'm saying is that even those laws, now Paul said as strongly as anybody, we're not under the law, but he saw in the law principles, spiritual principles, that are applicable and valid for us. So there's, you know, most of the Old Testament is not law, but even the parts that are law contain valuable spiritual principles. The only thing that we can say negatively about the law is that we're not under the law. That is, the law does not describe to us, as it did describe to the Jews, the proper way for them to worship God in the tabernacle. Well, we don't go to the tabernacle. We don't offer animal sacrifices. We don't have a priesthood of that type. And therefore, we're not under those laws. And those laws of cleanness and uncleanness and circumcision, all that, they were related to all of that. They weren't related to having a relationship with God. They were related to formal worship of God. And the relationship that men have with God was never defined by the law. Abraham lived even before the law, and he had a relationship with God, the same as we. The Bible says Abraham believed in the Lord, and it was accounted to him for righteousness. So his relationship with God was the same as ours, based on faith. Even after the law was given, that didn't change. David lived after the law. And yet, Paul tells us in Romans 4 that David knew very well the blessedness of being justified without the law. And what Paul's referring to is the fact that David slept with his neighbor's wife, Bathsheba, which under the law, he should have been put to death for that. And then he had her husband murdered, and then he should have been put to death for that too. He violated the law. And then when he finally repented, God said, well, I'm going to withhold the penalty for you. I'm not going to require that you die. And David at that time wrote a psalm, Psalm 32, where he said, how blessed is the man whose sin is forgiven and against whom God does not impute sin. And Paul quotes that verse in Psalm 32 over in Romans 4. At the beginning of Romans 4, Paul quotes Psalm 32:1. And he says, see, David knew what it was like to be righteous, to be forgiven without keeping the law. And so what Paul is saying is that both Abraham, before the law was given, and David, who lived after the law was given, both of them, the Bible testifies that they were justified, but not by the law. The law was not for people's justification. In fact, Paul says in Romans, by the works of the law shall no flesh be justified. So the purpose of the law was never to justify people or give them a relationship with God. The purpose of the law was to describe the formal worship of God that he wanted them to conduct under that old covenant. Well, we're under a new covenant now. The worship we conduct now is different. Paul said we worship God in spirit. Jesus said we worship God in spirit and in truth. He said men don't worship in Jerusalem and Mount Gerizim anymore. They worship God in spirit and truth. So we don't let the law dictate to us how to be clean or unclean or how to approach the tabernacle or not. That's not relevant to us in the same way. But it is relevant in other ways because those very laws contain the germ of spiritual truths that are relevant to our relationship with God. That's why it's still valuable for Christians to meditate day and night on the law of God and on the Old Testament in general. Remember, as I said, the Old Testament was the only Bible that Jesus and the apostles ever used, and they managed to preach and spread Christianity and live it pretty well with no other Bible than the Old Testament available to them. So I think that you could do the same. And that is why Christians should study the Old Testament. But the questioner asked, why do Christians concentrate on the Old Testament? Because the questioner said it's not relevant to Christians. Well, it is relevant. But even though it is relevant, I'm not sure that we could say Christians do concentrate on it. I think most Christians pay much too little attention to the Old Testament. Certainly a lot less attention than Jesus and the apostles spent on it. Look how often they quoted it. Dozens of times in the written scriptures. Maybe hundreds. And so that would be my short answer to that question. That short answer went for about 20 minutes or so. Anyway, I appreciate the call, Carolyn. Thank you for passing that question along. I hope that Ed was listening. Let's talk to Michael from Portland, Oregon. Michael, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve.
Hi.
God bless you, Steve.
Great to hear from you, Michael.
Thank you so much. Balaam, you know, my pronunciation is not always the right one. Balaam was somebody paid, I mean, he was in a situation when somebody was talking to him, Balaam.
Yeah, you may be pronouncing it wrongly, but you're pronouncing it the same way I do. So we may both be wrong.
Who spoke to Balaam?
You mean when he prayed?
No. When he was going through.
A donkey spoke to Balaam.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm a donkey.
You mean you're going to have to rebuke me like his donkey rebuked him?
Hey, Steve, I'm a donkey. Don't pay more attention than you pay to any donkey in the world. But I consider myself a donkey, what I'm planning to tell you in a few words.
Okay.
Steve, I know that, I don't know how many listeners do you have. Probably you have a lot of listeners, but...
At least three or four, because that's how many call.
Okay. Lately, in the last few weeks, in my meditation, in my prayer, in my moments of talking with God, I have an idea. I'm not saying that it's from God. I'm not a prophet. I'm just the last sinner in this world. And that's why I'm saying if you can listen to a donkey, I'm a donkey. But I'm here in America for 20 plus years, and I was listening to radio many... Hello?
Yes, I hear you. There was a noise, but I hear you.
Okay. Radio, television, and so on. And my heart is bleeding when I see how many people are distorting the gospel. When I met you, if you remember, of course, I said... If you remember again, I agree with you 80% or so. Well, the percentage doesn't count. I realize that I agree with you probably 20% now. But anyway, that's not important. What is important that you have the closest possible spreading of gospel, the right sense of gospel I ever heard on the radio, on and television. Now, let me get to my point. Bear with me. If you listen to this donkey from Romania, and if you want to put on the radio to your listeners, to our listeners, to pray, not to pray only, to pray hard, to God gave us a source of money. You must go on television. Before I continue, don't interrupt me, please. Steve, I know you are probably very well satisfied. Thank God I have a radio station. I have listeners. They are calling, blah, blah, blah. Good, very good. Perfect. But, if somebody, an idiot and a sinner and a donkey like me is telling you this time, if please pay attention, you cannot do it. We have to find a solution. You have to go in television because today in this world, television is the most popular way of preaching the right gospel. Think about that. You don't have to give me any answer today. Not tomorrow, not in a week, but think about that. And please tell your listeners to pray about this. Steve, today on television, I was watching television in the last 20 years, especially the most popular Christian television, and excuse me, my French, I feel like sometimes I have to vomit when I see what is preaching on television. Now, somebody must get there and tell people what is right, what is wrong, and what is the right gospel. You are not the only one. You are one. You can tell people because you are gifted from God to tell and explain the gospel in a very, very, very close way that Jesus meant to do it. If somehow God will make a miracle, and I will sell my dog, I will sell my house, and I have to help you, I will do it, but we have to go to spread the gospel the right way, because looking around today, the way the preachers, 90%, 90+% of the preacher who spreads the gospel is a gospel which has no power. It's a diluted gospel, and I'm very, very upset.
Well, Michael, let me jump in if I could. I appreciate your supportiveness about this. I'll tell you what my thoughts are about that. I'm not very inclined to go on television, even if the money was there. And there's two reasons for it. I'm not saying I would never do it. I mean, if God opened those doors and that was clearly the right thing, then I would do it. But there's three reasons. One is I don't think I'd look very good on television. But a second reason is that television is a very inefficient stewardship of money. It costs probably 100 times as much to be on television as to be on the radio. And if someone said, well, here's $1 million for you to expand your ministry, and I might think, well, I could go on television for a month, or I could be on the radio on 10 more stations, you know, for a year. And it would be hard for me to justify spending the money on television. Now, I realize that lots of people watch television, but one thing is that there's a lot of channels and a lot of people watch other things on television, not Christian stuff. Whereas on the radio, people can hear the radio at the beach. They can hear the radio in their cars. They can listen to it at home. It seems like radio reaches people a lot more places than television does. It also seems to me that people who are glued to the television are perhaps people who are more of the shallower type of persons, people who need more stimulation. And I don't know that my ministry would appeal to people who want stimulation. And most of the people who watch Christian TV, I think maybe they want to hear about how they can be healed and how they can prosper and how they can have their best life now and things like that. And those are not the things that I think the Bible teaches. They're not the kind of thing that I teach. I don't think they'd listen to me. And another thing is I'm kind of long-winded. I think I would bore them. But then there's one other. Well, those are pretty much the things. I don't know that I would go over well on TV. I don't know that it's a good use of money, even if the money was there. I don't know if it's good stewardship. And I also don't know that the kind of people who watch Christian television would be drawn to my program. I think they would just kind of change the channel when I was on, so that all that money that was spent would probably be wasted. Those are just my thoughts. I could be wrong, Michael, and maybe you're a donkey speaking for God, and if so, I suppose circumstances may prove this so. I don't watch TV. I don't have a TV, so I don't really, but I have occasionally seen Christian TV, and I think I couldn't do that. I couldn't put that image forward. I couldn't have this fake, studio and have this all this showmanship. And besides, I look more like a hippie. You know, I couldn't put my hair up in a big, whatever they call it, hairstyle and stuff. I just don't think it would work out for me. But
Dave,
go ahead. Yeah.
In this situation, I agree with you 50%. The first, point, I do not agree. I agree with you zero. The second one, I try to agree with you. I mean, the first one, you don't look good on television. Hey, man, I saw you. You are a very good-looking man. let me tell you.
What? I don't look like I belong on Christian television.
No, you are a very good-looking man, Steve. Second, okay. Do you think that Crooked Peter, who we never know what was his problem, but he didn't look a very handsome and a macho man to be
okay.
a television star. Hey, let's put that aside. You look much more better than you're supposed to do for a television. The second one, I agree with you another 50% from the second point that probably people are not listening, but I tend to believe that looking at some I had a few years with I didn't have television in my house, yeah. And I was the happiest man on the world, but a few years ago my wife said I need an internet and I had to get a television, the devil in my house. Sorry, I'm not that idiot. I mean, I'm just kidding, you know.
Michael.
No, let me finish, please. And then I was watching television, and then a lot of people, let me tell you, I don't know, I mean, you know, I don't know listeners if they know, a lot of if ignoramus, when people, the preacher in a television say, listen to me, in a 5 minutes I'm going to, the Holy Spirit, Spirit will go on top of me, go to the television, touch the television, and send your money at least another day, 365 a day. And then if they are right, I really don't know. I have no idea how to check. But the sum they count, millions of dollars they gain in a few days. They want to make, they need the money. And I'm sure people listen to television more than you think.
Okay.
More than you think.
I need to interrupt you, Michael. I love to listen to you talk. Partly I love your accent, and I also like it because you always say nice things. But I take your message, and we'll see what God does. My lines are full, and I only have a couple minutes. I
God
need to
bless
think
you.
About
God going. Bless you. God bless you. Bye.
God bless you, Michael. Thanks for your call. Good to hear from you again. Let's talk to Christopher from Portland, Oregon next. Hello, Christopher.
Hello, Steve. I really like Michael. He has a certain Romanian charm that's irresistible.
Isn't he charming? Yeah.
Yeah, he's a very interesting guy. I like him. Just a quick comment. Going off what Michael was saying, I really want you to do YouTube videos, and that's a free way that, like, you,
I
don't know,
yeah.
I think if you got on there, you'd be surprised how many views you could drum up if you put out, a series of videos. I think that'd be fantastic.
Well, I'll tell you something, Christopher. This school I'm going to be teaching in the summertime, it's going to be videotaped, and there will be over 200 lectures in 10 weeks, and we will put those on the Internet for people to see. Some of it could be YouTubed or something. So we will be, it will be able to be viewed.
I think that's great. I'd totally watch those. And then I think using something like that and then also just engaging that community would be great. If you could get a low-quality camera as long as it picks up your audio well, and you could address people's atheist questions on YouTube. You could cover certain subjects like you do on your radio show. I don't know. I think that'd be fantastic. And it's all.
I think that'll eventually happen. The main thing is I'm just so busy now with other things. I don't know that I can really go there. But I mean, I'm for it. I'm in favor of that.
Yeah, yeah. It's such a strange tool, all in tagging certain things. And I don't know. I could. And it's free. So.
Okay. Now, Christopher, is that what you called about?
That's it. Just a quick comment.
Okay. Because are you still an atheist?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
Sometimes I wonder if you're faking it, that you're an atheist.
No. But I'm a big fan of your show.
I know. That's what makes me think it's strange.
Yeah, no, I learned more about the Bible from your show than any other Christian radio show. And I listen to a lot of them. I like to learn about, more and more I learn about all the different religions, the better. Christianity is the more interesting one, for me. But yeah, I'm still an atheist, but, I enjoy learning about the Bible and your religion. It's an interesting religion.
Well, you hadn't called for a long time, so I thought maybe something horrible happened to you, like you got converted.
Well, if I ever get converted, you would be the first to know, Steve.
Great. That's good. Well, I take your point, and I think we'll probably have some YouTube videos going up before too long.
Excellent. Well, I will. I'm always listening. I'll be calling you up again soon, and we could argue a little bit.
Good. I've missed our conversations.
I do too. All right. Enjoy the night, Steve.
All right, Christopher. Thank you. Bye now. You know, we got Kyle from Minneapolis, Minnesota, but I don't know if he wants to be on for just like 60 seconds. I'll give you a chance, Kyle. If that's too short, you might want to call tomorrow. Hi, Kyle.
Hi, Steve. My question again relates to women in ministry, and generally those elicit a longer response. So I'll let you have the floor for the last 60 seconds, and I'll call tomorrow.
Yeah, we can't really cover that one issue in 60 seconds, can we?
No.
All right. Well, give me a call tomorrow. We can talk about that.
God bless, Steve.
Thank you. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Yeah. Well, you've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast, and it was not a setup. It was not a setup for some callers to call up and say kind things about this program. I of course, never know who's going to call any given day. But I appreciate those of you who think well of the program. And even those of you who don't think well but are listening anyway, maybe you'll get turned around on it. The Narrow Path is a daily program, live from 2 to 3 in the afternoon Pacific time on several radio stations. And my name is Steve Gregg, and we have a website where you can access, maybe not video and not television, but you can access hundreds of MP3 files of lectures of mine, teaching verse by verse through the whole Bible and also on several hundred different topics, in-depth biblical teaching on them. And it's all free. You may have noticed if you've been listening for the whole hour, we don't take a break for a commercial, although some of those calls might sound like commercials for us. But we don't really sell anything. And so we depend on the Lord, really, to keep us on the air. Mostly, the Lord provides through listeners. And if you're a listener and would like to help us stay on the air, you can write to The Narrow Path at P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. That's The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. Now, the website is www.thenarrowpath.com. And in addition to about 900 MP3 files that you can get there for free, there's also written documents on different subjects, articles I've written for magazines and so forth. And everything there is free. There's nothing for sale at the website. So check it out, please. TheNarrowPath.com. I appreciate you joining us today. Thanks to those who called. We'll talk again to you tomorrow, Lord willing. Have a great evening.